This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, a study has found a key component of Australia's aid to the Pacific is not making a strong enough impact. And it says competition with China is behind the lag. We'll speak to the study's author coming up. And it's a tragic set of numbers. At the height of Australia's pandemic, people born in Tonga and Samoa were at least 50 times more likely to die of COVID than those born in the country. But a group of committed community workers are making sure the situation improves.
There's a new variant, and we do not know what's going to happen as well in the future. We are ready to, you know, face anything, any challenge that comes along.
And we head to Vanuatu, where for the first time, a group of Indigenous archaeologists have found a key exploration site holding clues to the Pacific's ancient ancestors. All that and more today on the show. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. So glad to have your company. First, though, threats, intimidation, and sometimes death can meet the men and women tasked with making sure fishing crews in the Pacific follow the law. And now, after 2 years off the job because of COVID-19, these fisheries observers are coming back to this dangerous work, which has seen at least 9 reported deaths or suspicious disappearances in the last 11 years. Marion Farr looks at what's being done to improve the safety in the sector.
For more than 2 years, fisheries observers around the Pacific have spent most of their time on dry land.
During this COVID period, there's been a significant impact on the suspension of basically their livelihood.
The pandemic presented unique risks to those tasked with providing important oversight of fishing activities in the region. But as of next year, hundreds of observers will finally return to work.
It's taken quite some time, and I think also necessary time, so that we're all confident as a collective that our observers can be safely redeployed.
Manu Tupou-Rosen is Director General of the Pacific Islands Forum Fisheries Agency, the peak regional body that helps Pacific countries manage their fishing resources. At a meeting in Vietnam this week, members have agreed to redeploy fisheries observers from January 1.
Having them back on vessels, of course, is re-engaging our observers back to that important task and a source of livelihood for them, but also a really critical source of information for both science and for compliance.
For many, it will be a relief to return to work. But COVID-19 is not the only danger that fisheries observers face.
Working at sea is inherently dangerous.
Bubba Cook is the Western and Central Pacific Tuna Program Manager for the Worldwide Fund for Nature.
There's all sorts of things that anyone working on a fishing vessel can encounter, not the least of which is, you know, rough seas and dangerous conditions, wet decks. A small injury can become septic very quickly, and you can die ultimately from a small injury.
A WWF report found that over the past 11 years, at least 9 observers have died or disappeared in unnecessary or worse, in suspicious circumstances.
The bigger concern that we have in recent years is the number of observers that have been subject to threats, intimidation, and assault while serving on board vessels. Observers are at best a nuisance and at worst a threat to the crew on board and to the owners, because they, you know, collect information that can ultimately impact the bottom line of that vessel.
So what is being done to protect fisheries observers when they return to work? Manu Tupou-Rosen says the Forum Fisheries Agency undertook a study into the safety and livelihoods of observers. They looked at ways that observers could do their work on land using digital tools.
It's a huge opportunity for electronic monitoring in terms of having observers and their wide experience on vessels as eyes and ears to undertake analyses of electronic monitoring data, basically video footage, and they are just so brilliant at that.
The FFA is also running safety refresher courses for workers and developing a new observer compensation scheme.
If there's an observer that's been hurt or injured, if there's an observer that's unfortunately passed, the types of compensation that could be accorded to the observer or to the family. And so it's set up like an insurance scheme, and it's work that's still being developed by our membership, but certainly They're well behind this.
FFA members have also adopted a suite of recommendations made by the WWF. Here's Bubba Cook.
Ensuring that vessels stop fishing whenever an observer is missing or becomes injured, and return to port or conduct search operations. You know, basic measures that you'd think would be common sense, but they're now codified as a conservation and management measure.
Mr. Cook says getting fisheries observers back to work is an important step.
There's a term called the observer effect that is well documented, that when observers are on board fishing vessels, the vessels behave differently than if the observers aren't there. So I think you can conclude that there has probably been a lapse in compliance during the period that observers were not deployed.
But he believes there's still more to be done.
The fact that we've still had a number of fatalities on board fishing vessels of observers have occurred since the observer safety and security measure went into effect is testament to the fact that we haven't done enough. There's still more that needs to be done. And, you know, we've said repeatedly that, you know, no vessel should ever bring home bodies, but should bring home people. And if, you know, observers fall ill or if crew fall ill on board those vessels, it is the responsibility of the flag state to ensure that they come home healthy and not in a body bag.
That was Bubba Cook, from the World Wide Fund for Nature, ending Marion Farr's report. Thanks for joining me here on Pacific Beat. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. One of Australia's key foreign policy initiatives is under fire for failing to meet the region's greatest needs. The $4 billion Australian Infrastructure Financing Facility provides loans and grants to build things like roads, bridges, and telecommunication cables in the region. But a new report says Australia's focus on countering China's influence is hampering the facility's impact. Joining me now is Dr. Luke Fletcher from the Australia Jubilee Research Centre. They're the ones who produced the report. Good morning to you, Dr. Fletcher.
Good morning, Priyanka. How are you?
Yes, I'm well. So what is your concern when it comes to the Australian Infrastructure Financing Facility?
Well, our report has done a sort of systematic review of the program, looking at a whole lot of issues like is there transparency in the reporting? It's called the AIFFP, the Australian Infrastructure Financing Facility for the Pacific. So I'll just call it the AIFFP. Is it leading to positive development outcomes? As you said, is there a geopolitical logic behind the projects? Is it increasing sovereign debt? Is it addressing issues such as climate change, poverty reduction? And so these are the questions that the report asks. And unfortunately, as you indicated in your introduction, in many of these areas, we find that the program's design means that it is coming up short in a lot of these areas.
Can we go into specifics? I mean, is it all these areas?
Sure.
Do you have an example, perhaps, where this facility is falling short?
Yeah, look, basically our criticism, and it's really been a criticism all along since when it was established in 2019, is that the design of the program, whilst it makes it, because it's three quarters loan-based and only one quarter in grants, so it's a move of the aid program away from grants and towards loans, is a good vehicle in many ways for doing geopolitical lending, but not for other purposes. So, for example, because it's a loan program, it really has to go for bankable projects mostly. The vast majority of its projects have to be bankable to justify the loans. And what this means is that the program is skewed towards large infrastructure programs to the bigger economies in the region, such as PNG and Fiji, which potentially have the capacity to pay back these loans, although that's, you know, also questionable, and also to projects like large infrastructure projects, and not, as we said earlier, to things that the region really needs and really needs from our aid program, such as meeting the vast needs of climate change adaptation and other development, positive development outcomes. And so as an example, by far the biggest dollar value, even though we looked at about sort of 14 or 15 projects, that are being implemented or various stages being implemented, by dollar value, the majority of the money is going to this big PNG ports redevelopment, about $620 million or so of the $1 billion or so of disbursements that we looked at. So that's almost two-thirds is going to this one program, PNG Ports Infrastructure Investment Program, and we know very little about the purpose of that because of the lack of transparency. We don't know, for example, how much of the of that ports redevelopment is going to facilitate more mining, logging and agribusiness such as destructive oil palm development in the country, just because we have so little information about that. So that's an example of like the skewing towards these large infrastructure and large development programs, which for where they're sort of questionable, I guess, outcomes.
Mm. I mean, some would argue that a port and some of these big infrastructure projects that this facility is funding can be necessary and a benefit. I took a look at some of the other projects funded. There are things like funding improving airport infrastructure in Fiji, building a solar plant also in Papua New Guinea. Are there some other projects that you do see benefits in as part of this facility?
Yeah, look, it's a really good question, Priyanka. I mean, generally speaking, this is sort of, you know, in general terms, I think we're pretty comfortable and supportive of the renewable energy transition projects. You mentioned there's some solar plants in places like Palau and potentially solar developments in PNG. There's a big hydro power development in the Solomon Islands, which our contacts in the Solomons tell us is actually in many ways a very positive project. Despite the lack of information we got from the project documents, our research suggested that's called the Tina River Hydro Power Transmission System, part of the Tina River Hydro, which we think is a pretty good project actually. So for the renewable energy transition projects, we're pretty comfortable with them, although we would like more information to really assess them properly. But yeah, as I said, the big transport infrastructure questions that have a lot of, you're right, the ports development could be really good in PNG, but we just don't know how it's going to benefit the country. Most of the population in PNG, 90% live in small communities, farming, you know, subsistence agriculture. Is it going to help them get their products to market? Most of that is produced for the domestic market. You know, very little money for these communities and for the most of the people in PNG comes from things like cash crops. That could be a big development opportunity for PNG, but we don't see any evidence so far that this is what the program is intended to help. Right, so that's a big question mark. In terms of the airports and the tourism infrastructure in Fiji, that's another good question. I mean, in theory, that could be a positive thing, but we would question whether that's really something that the aid program should be spending money on. I mean, first of all, how deep an impact on the Fiji population given that these loans are going to be paid back by the people of Fiji. Are these tourist dollars going to reach into the ordinary lives of the ordinary Fijian, or is it going to be benefiting really a small part of the population? We know that the Fiji is a tourism dependent economy, but is it the sort of broad based development that we really need for the Pacific? These are the sort of questions that we feel haven't really been asked, and it's very hard to get a handle on. Mm. So that's where the sort of critiques are coming from. If that makes sense.
And as part of your research, Dr. Fletcher, did you speak to people in the Pacific about their thoughts on these projects?
I mean, we work in the Pacific on a sort of daily basis across a number of areas. Obviously, we're looking at the aid program, but we're also on a daily basis looking at a big big extraction in mining, in logging, and this sort of thing. So we have good relations with partners in PNG and Fiji and elsewhere in the Pacific. So we didn't in terms of the research model for this particular report, we did have a couple of in-depth conversations when we felt with partners when we felt like we didn't have enough information. But most of the information for this particular report was a desk-based research project. So you know, a sort of more extent. One of the recommendations of our report, Priyanka, is that a more extensive review of the project is needed, and that would really need to be a deep dive with a lot of resources. We sort of didn't really have the resources in the organisation to do that for this particular report, but we do feel like a deep dive is needed, and those sort of conversations could happen then.
If you are just joining us here on Pacific Beat, we're speaking with Dr. Luke Fletcher. He's the Executive Director of Australia Jubilee's Research Centre. We're talking about this new report looking at Australia's funding facility for Pacific countries and how it might be falling short. I mean, one of the outcomes of this study, Dr. Fletcher, is looking at how China's and the geopolitics in the region is influencing Australia's aid decisions. What have you found?
So, there's no question that some of the projects funded by this program do have geopolitical elements to them. For example, if you look at the undersea cables that these are relatively, in terms of the dollar value, they're actually a relatively small part of the program because the loans are quite small for, and then the grants are actually, they're mostly grants actually for the undersea cables in Palau, and there's an, it was called the East Micronesia cable in the, in Micronesia, Kiribati and Nauru. And so they are definitely to counter sort of the Chinese attempt to establish telecommunications infrastructure in the region. So, you know, no question that they're geopolitical there. That's not necessarily a problem to have. We know that sometimes, you know, Australia and the Department of Foreign Affairs is going to want to, I guess, there's strategic competition going on. You know, in the Pacific, everybody knows that, and we understand that sometimes Australian taxpayer dollars are going to be part of that geostrategic competition. We question again whether this should be part of the aid program, though. I mean, this really should be additional money not coming out of the aid budget. Its primary purpose should be for things like poverty alleviation, justice, gender programs, and particularly climate change adaptation. So that's the, we don't obviously have an issue with Australia wanting to sometimes, you know, we understand there's competition going on, but, you know, whether that's really appropriate to come to the aid program is the problem there.
And I understand this facility, this infrastructure financing facility is a loan, that they provide loans to these various projects in the Pacific. Now, often China is the one accused of debt trap diplomacy, where governments can take out big, massive loans to try and fund these projects and then have difficulty paying them back. Is Australia at risk of doing the same thing here?
I mean, the short answer is yes, it is. The program is now $3 billion in loans and $1 billion in grants. So it's what's called sort of a mixed facility. The Australian aid program, one of the strengths of the Australian aid program traditionally, apart from a period in the 80s where you had a similar facility being set up, is that it has been a grant-based aid program. This has come from a push in the development sector to establish a loan facility because it was perceived that something like this was needed. And we questioned it at the time when it was set up in 2019. We're still very sceptical that a loan-based program can work. We don't know enough really to be able to say it's going to increase debt problems because, for example, some of the countries that are being identified are only being given grants if they're at you know, the World Bank, the IMF put them at risk of debt distress, then they're only receiving grants. The problem with that is that these at-risk countries, which is about half of the countries identified, are then only going to be able to get very small amounts of aid because the grant envelope of this is so small. And the other problem is that, therefore, in the converse of that, most of the big loans are going to go to the bigger economies like PNG and like Fiji. And therefore, it's going to be skewed towards, as I said before, these bankable projects in the big economies, which may be able to pay them back. But we don't have a business case for these big projects, like, for example, the ports program that I mentioned at the beginning of the interview. Mm-hmm. We don't have a business case because of the lack of transparency. There may well be a business case being prepared by the agencies involved, which is DFAT and Export Finance Australia. But because they're not released to the public, we don't have, civil society and the general public don't have any visibility on what these business cases are and whether it is going to, whether it's a sovereign borrower or whether it's a private entity who's the borrower is going to be in trouble later down the track. When these loans have to be paid back. So that's the issue there.
Yeah, as we've been hearing, Dr. Fletcher, you've been calling for more transparency over this facility, the AIFFP. I much prefer that acronym rather than the full title. But there has been an independent review just last year. It didn't find any red flags. Now, of course, your study has reached different conclusions. Why do you think there is this differing opinion in light of this independent review?
Look, the review just came out a couple of weeks ago. We'd already finished the report and we had to go back and it was already with the designer. But we had a look at the review. The main issue I think there is in terms of the view were quite limited. Because of the way that it was, the terms were set up and the way that the reviewer interpreted those terms, it wasn't really able to address what we thought were the most important questions around whether, whether development challenges in its partner companies are being met by this program. So it didn't successfully answer the question about whether the investments are likely to have economic and social benefits. It sort of just inferred them from the kind of theoretical setup and by comparing the AIFFP to the multilateral development banks, which is not really a sufficient way to answer that question. And the other thing is the review didn't involve civil society at all. So as far as we know anyway, and certainly didn't come to us for our thoughts, given that we're the main actor in the aid sector in Australia who's been talking about this program since its inception in 2019. So, you know, we think that a proper review will have to have very different terms of reference and really needs to involve civil society in its design, because we just feel like, there might have been good intentions behind that review, but it really did come up short. And then if a proper review is done, a more thorough review is done that makes recommendations, that shows that it's not really working across those criteria, then the program really needs to be redesigned. That's really important.
Dr. Luke Fletcher, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you very much, Priyanka.
That was Dr. Luke Fletcher, the Executive Director of Australia's Jubilee Research Centre. We were talking about their new study, criticising Australia's infrastructure financing facility.
Join me, Hilda Wayne, for Sisters Let's Talk. I'll be interviewing incredible guests and discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
When you're younger, you don't really take note of the significance of this ritual until you're much older. Then you realize that you're proud to be part of this ritual.
So join me, Hilda Wayne, for Sisters Let's Talk, Wednesdays at 3:30 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
It's time to find out what's making news, or I guess the other news making news around the region, apart from what we can get to in other segments in Pacific Beat. Anyway, to do that, as always, joined by reporter Carl Evans. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning, Priyanka. Wednesday already.
Yes, Wednesday already. Yes, almost to the end of the week. And look, we're getting more cybersecurity stories, which is quite surprising. Samoa has narrowly avoided a major cyber attack. Of course, this comes after Vanuatu's cyber attack. Can you tell us what's happened here in Samoa?
Yeah, they're becoming pretty concerningly regular these days, it looks like.
But even in Australia.
Yeah, but luckily some quick action by police in Samoa has actually saved the government from potentially losing hundreds of thousands of Tala to hackers. So this is reported by the Samoa Observer, and they said the Land Transport Authority and a local construction company were the intended victims of these hackers. It's understood the hackers had hacked email exchanges between these two parties. However, the activity was detected by New Zealand police as the LTA was actually trying to make payments to a New Zealand firm.
Oh, wow.
So luckily, they were able to inform Samoa's Ministry of Police in the nick of time.
Yeah, so it sounds all by chance. Just the chance that it went to a New Zealand firm meant the New Zealand police were onto it. And do we know who these hackers were?
Yeah, no details on that yet. But we do know, like we mentioned, this definitely isn't the first attack to have take place in the Pacific in recent weeks. Vanuatu, as we know, is still crippled from that major attack a few weeks ago. Interestingly, the police commissioner of Samoa did say it might be time to consider setting up a proper cybersecurity unit.
Yeah, and that seems to be coming out of that Vanuatu case as well, where there's a sort of more attention on perhaps not well-resourced cybersecurity and that things should be, more attention is needed in that space. Very interesting to see the number. I mean, obviously, these are two unrelated instances, the one in Vanuatu and Samoa. The Vanuatu one was a ransomware attack. Someone has attacked me with a ransomware attack as well before. Obviously, if it attacks a government, it's far more serious. But yeah, they pretty much, at least what happened to me, is they locked down everything on your computer and then ask you to pay in my case, it was some money into a Russian bank account. I didn't do that. And to this day, a lot of files from about 10 years ago are lost. But Vanuatu, I understand, is getting help from Australia. Samoa seems to have gotten help from New Zealand. So hopefully things are still standing up there at least.
Yeah, I guess it raises the question if the Pacific is particularly vulnerable to those sorts of attacks. And if so, how can they improve their infrastructure?
Indeed. And now let's head to a fishing story. We heard about fisheries observers coming back and some of the concerns and benefits there. Now the Marine Stewardship Council is threatening to strip a number of Pacific tuna fisheries of certification. Why is that? What's happening?
Yeah, so it's another pretty interesting one. So the MSC has warned 33 certified tuna fisheries that they may lose their certification if the Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Commission fails to adopt new management measures to harvest skipjack tuna. So the WCPFC's meeting in Vietnam at the moment,
which we
heard earlier on. And for a bit of context, so this certification certificate, that's that blue label that appears on tuna packaging. So MSC's concern is that the current strategies threaten the long-term sustainability of the tuna, and part of having that blue certification means that not only is the stock productive and healthy, but the harvesting practices have minimal impact on the marine environment, and I guess at the moment they think it doesn't.
Yeah, very interesting. That report was from Island Business there about MSC, and tuna fisheries are so important in the Pacific region. It will be interesting to see what impact that loss of certification might have, or if they can, in the nick of time, improve, I guess, some of those regulations and get that certification back. Because I know a lot of consumers, at least, I don't eat tuna myself, but I know a lot of people do look out for those labels when they shop, and that's what entices them to get their tuna, I guess. And now a new defense outpost has been announced in the Solomon Islands. What's this all about? Well, when we hear about defense outposts, we think of China and geopolitics.
I think outpost is a key word. Definitely not a base. Don't say the word base. But no, a Western border outpost will be established on Shortland Island as part of a joint venture with the Solomon Islands government and the Australian Defence Force.
So, interesting.
This was reported by the Solomon Islands Times late yesterday. And once it's finished, it will be home to the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force as well as immigration officials.
Very, very interesting. Do we know exactly what this outpost, not a base, is?
We'll do. So the information that we have, so it's basically just going to enhance border security as well as surveillance capabilities. So look, I'm sure that is a blanket term for a number of different things. Interestingly, though, Hell's Point Explosive Ordnance Disposal Facility in Honiara, so that's the EOD ordnance disposal teams, their facility will also get a pretty big upgrade as part of this deal as well.
Oh, yeah, and I know you've done some stories about that ordnance removal. That's getting rid mainly of World War II bombs, is that right?
Yeah,
still exist in the country.
It seems to be, finding more of it 80 years on. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, and causing actually some injuries and sometimes death. So hopefully that upgrade will be, well received. And we'll see what that outpost gets to do. And we'll see if China, we're seeing this sort of cat and mouse game between China and Australia, where one one team, one country does one thing, in particularly in Solomon Islands, and then we see the other country provide something else, and this sort of one-upmanship. And, you know, I think both sides deny that they're looking to the other country to, you know, decide on where they put their aid and put their efforts. But you can't help but notice that. And hearing this story, I wonder if China has something.
Absolutely,
up their sleeves
as well. It's the timing is significant, I guess. You know, on the back of Anthony Albanese's promises to engage more with the Pacific, and yeah, I think we'll be seeing a lot more of that.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Kyle, for those stories.
Thank you, Priyanka.
That was reporter Kyle Evans bringing us the latest from around the region. But don't go anywhere. As I said, we've got some news for you here on Pacific Beat as well. We'll be speaking to an archaeologist in Vanuatu because, for the first time, Indigenous people in Vanuatu have discovered an ancient Lapita site. They found these shards of clay and animal bones in it. It's been reported that it's the first time Indigenous archaeologists have actually made a find like this. We'll find out how significant this exploration is. And I've got some pretty scary statistics for you. After taking age into account, the statisticians here in Australia, ABS, which is our national statistics board, found that people from Tonga were about 80 times more likely to die than people born in Australia during our latest COVID-19 pandemic, during the height of it. It's pretty concerning, 80 times more likely to die. But people in the community are taking note and are trying to challenge this. We'll be hearing soon about how a group has come together to improve how children, Pacifica children here in Australia, think about their health through music and books. Do stick around for that. Listening to Pacific Beat on your Wednesday morning. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. Now for a story out of the city of Sydney here in Australia. Many victims of Australia's COVID-19 outbreak were Pacific Islanders. In fact, the highest death rates from the virus were seen in people born in Tonga and Samoa. Improving awareness and education is seen as a key to countering these poor health outcomes. And as Dubrovka Voloday reports, a new book launched in Western Sydney last night aims to do this by targeting children.
Music and storytelling are an important part of Pacific culture, and now with a modern twist.
If you have a fever, be sure to take a test. If you're really tired, stay at home and get some rest.
Members of the Core Pacific Collective launched this sing-along video this week teaching children to stay healthy.
If you have a temperature, check it every day. Fruits and veggies, plenty water, what you need to
So the interactive children's book as well as the sing-along videos were really to bring the voice of our children into the space of developing solutions, strategies to addressing the issues around COVID-19. That is to actually stay safe.
Luau Donina Va'a is the chairperson of the Pacific Women's Professional Business Network in Sydney's West.
Hearing the messages through stories.
Across Australia, the COVID-19 death toll was the highest in Pacific communities. According to the Bureau of Statistics, people born in Tonga were 80 times more likely to die than those born in Australia. Western Sydney was one of the worst affected areas during the COVID lockdowns. Ms. Va'a says COVID is here to stay and they want the community to be prepared.
Yes, COVID started in 2020, but as we see, there's a new variant and we do not know what's going to happen as well in the future. We are ready to, you know, face anything, any challenge that comes along.
The group also launched an interactive children's book called Little Health Inspectors, featuring Pacifica characters. Sela Atiola is an early childhood educator who wrote the story with the help of small children in the community.
Devita and Lani love their grandma Sil, but she's been sick in bed, fatigued with a cough and a very sore head. Grandma Seal normally has more energy and is super strong, but she is not as hungry now and her day naps are long. Health experts say that COVID-19 has entered our shores and we need to be more careful than ever before.
The characters were developed by the children, some of them only 2 or 3 years old.
There was a lot of kind of prompting and, you know, asking and drawing. You know, I got them to draw who was in their family. You know, does it consist of mum, dad, grandma, grandpa, auntie? So that's kind of where the storyline and the characters emerged from.
She says there's a gap for Pacific children's literature.
I think throughout the pandemic, and especially in the Pacific community, resources for children was quite lacking. And I found, just in general as an educator, that resources for Pacific children in Australia in particular, in terms of literature, is almost non-existent. I don't want to say it's non-existent, but it is very lacking.
The book and videos are in English, but the group hopes to translate them into 6 Pacific languages in the near future.
Cover your mouth and wash your hands with soap and water, please.
That was Dubravka Volodar with that report, and it ended on one of those songs that that help improve health outcomes for children there in Sydney. And if you want to access any of these children's resources, you can head to the Pacific Women's Professional Business Network and the New South Wales Core Pacific Collective website, and you'll be able to find them there.
Pacific Beat.
And we were hoping to get you to Vanuatu to speak to an archaeologist there. Unfortunately, we were having a bit of trouble reaching him. But it's all good because I've got another stellar story to bring to you. When Albert Chan boarded a flight from Tonga to Australia in April 2021, he never imagined his 6-month stint of seasonal work would turn into almost 2 years. Border closures amid the COVID-19 pandemic, during which a volcanic eruption cut off contact with families, meant he and thousands of other Tongan nationals are about to finally fly home. Eliza Bellage caught up with Albert during his lunch break at a fruit pack house in South Australia's Riverland.
My name is Albert Chan. I'm originally from Tonga. I work for COSTAL, known as Acri Exchange, here in Renmark, South Australia.
While this isn't Mr. Chan's first stint working away from home, it's certainly been his longest.
Well, I've been here for like 18 months already, yeah, since April 2021. I started coming over here since 2017, yeah, and we couldn't make it on 2020 because of the COVID. Yeah, no flight, and then we finally make it on like 2021 to come over. And then we were expecting to just come over for like 6 to 7 months, then we go home. But end of the season, we didn't make it. What happened, we couldn't get a flight back home because of the COVID. Back home, our country, the border was still locked. So we couldn't make it home. And then the company has to find us more work to do.
That would be quite hard to process, not being able to go home when you expect. Do you remember how you felt when you found out that news?
Yeah, it was pretty sad, yeah, and some of the boys were disappointed because they were expecting to see their families, because normally it's just 6 months, and now it's been the longest time that we're away from home, especially most of the boys. They didn't expect that.
The federal government granted more than 13,000 visa extensions to help stranded seasonal workers continue working in key industries like agriculture. More than a quarter of those went to Tongan nationals like Mr. Chan, who says his employer Costa Group found him additional work after the citrus season ended in the Riverland.
We end up going to Tasmania picking berries. Yeah, our blueberries, blackberries, strawberries and raspberry. Yeah, for a couple months, and then we have to come back here for the start of the season this year.
But while there's been plenty of support, he says the distance from family has been tough, especially amid disaster and disease.
Been a lot of challenges since we were here. Especially when we went to Tasmania, that was the first time that we got the COVID. Yeah, and then when we were quarantined with the COVID, and then we heard the thing that happened back home, the volcano and the tsunami.
The magnitude 5.8 earthquake on January 15 destroyed Tonga's phone and internet connection to the outside world.
And it was that time, it was pretty sad and it was pretty difficult. Boys were worried about their families. Network couldn't get any network back home to contact their family to see how they, check on them, how they are. Yeah, it was pretty hard. Yeah, for me, it took like almost a month to contact my family.
Must have been such a relief when you heard from them and they were all right?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, since I heard from them, yeah, they messaged me. And oh, thank God they're still alive. Yeah, because we were from the other islands. Yeah, I think they were lucky when the volcano and the tsunami hit Tonga, because we were here. Once we get connected with them, then we send them money. Yeah, even the company that we work for, Costa, they load up a container full of food to support the families back home. Yeah, it was, we do appreciate their help and, yeah.
So you're flying back home in less than a month. How do you feel about that?
Pretty exciting. Looking forward to see the families for like over a year and a half now, almost 2 years. And the beaches, swimming, because we live in an island, we always swim every day.
Have you got like a first meal planned or somewhere you're going to stop and get food from or someone's house you're going to go to?
Normally when we go back home, the families will prepare seafood. Yeah, normally they get like octopus, oyster, lobster. Yeah, they get like those kind of food. Yeah, fish, the big one, raw fish.
So you've been to Australia a few times, but this time was a lot longer than you expected. Do you think you'll come back?
Yes, I do. I do. I'm going to come back next season because normally this is where we get money to support our families back home. Back home is hard to get money and a good job. But we do get good money here when we work in Australia. And yeah, just support my mum. She lives in a different island. And my grandparents, they live in a different island. And when we game over, most of the boys have their own goals and yeah, what they're going to work for and use their money for. I've been like bought a new car, a piece of land with the money that I got from working here in Australia, which is good, and support the family as well.
That was Riverland reporter Eliza Burlage speaking there with Tongan seasonal worker Albert Chen. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Apologies again, we were trying to get that archaeologist from Vanuatu, but hey, live radio, we'll try them later in the week. But thank you for listening to all our stories here on Pacific Beat this Wednesday morning. Do stick around, news is next. And if you want to catch up, do tune in to the afternoon version of Pacific Beat.